Why do many people feel that their dogs truly understand them, provide loving support, and seem to know exactly what they're thinking, while their cats couldn't care less? While humans and animals have always coexisted, the process of domestication has had profound effects on animal species and human civilization, and it's the topic of this week's Please Explain. Joining us now is Richard Francis, the author of Epigenetic and Why Won't Men Ask for Directions, most recently Domesticated: Evolution in a Man-Made World. It's published by W.W. Norton and will be released in a couple of weeks. Richard, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Richard, you identify the Neolithic Revolution as a turning point for humans and other animals. Why then?
Well, the Neolithic Revolution, the agricultural revolution, is when humans sort of abandon the hunter-gatherer lifestyle for a more sedentary existence, which in turn created the conditions for urban life as we know it and high culture as we know it.
And also, a huge growth of the human population.
Exactly. When the revolution started, there was, just on the order of 100,000 humans. And now, of course, there are 7 billion of us or more.
Didn't many species go extinct around the time of the Neolithic?
Well, around the Neolithic, not so much, but they certainly locally became extinct as the populations grew. Extinctions caused by humans actually preceded the Neolithic Revolution. For example, it's a bit controversial, but when humans colonized North America and Australia, there was a coincidental decline in the large animal populations and extinctions.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I gather horses were almost made extinct, and luckily some of them drifted over to Asia, survived that way.
That's exactly right. The horses actually evolved in North America, but they migrated over the Bering Land Bridge into Asia when the sea levels were lower, and it was there that they sort of bought the time to become domesticated.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they were just food. You write, no domesticated species has ever become extinct.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Well, that's in stark contrast to their wild ancestors, which several of which have become extinct, and others are just teetering on the brink as we speak. For example, the wild ancestors of the horse is extinct. The wild ancestor of the cattle is extinct. The wild ancestors of sheep and goats are very endangered.
So might cows, pigs, sheep, goats, chickens, yaks, bison, horses have gone extinct if humans hadn't begun to domesticate them?
Yes. The only way cattle survived was via domestication. And now they're one of the more common large mammals on Earth.
But aren't there some animals, mammals, that we haven't domesticated that also depend on humans, like rodents and raccoons?
Sure, and that's a common route to domestication. Those animals that you refer to are sometimes called commensals. They prefer human-altered environments. Pigeons are another example of that. And they thrive in human environments. For example, mice have totally abandoned their wild habitats, house mice, and completely depend on human altered habitats for their livelihood, and they thrive quite well there. So those mice and other commensals are automatically candidates for domestication should humans decide that they're useful in that way.
And what were
and
the
for mice?
Go ahead.
For mice, that happened relatively recently, where these people decided to make pets out of them. Mm. And then from those pets, the lab mice were derived.
And then we have hamsters also as pets.
Yes.
Now, what were the first domesticated species?
The first species to be domesticated was a dog, and it was the only one to be domesticated prior to the agricultural revolution. Some people think the dog was domesticated as early as 30,000 years ago. That others somewhere between 17 and 20,000 years ago. So that precedes the agricultural revolution by at least 5,000 years.
My guest is Richard Francis, whose latest book is Domesticated: Evolution in a Man-Made World. It's published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we invite your calls. If you want to join this conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Didn't wolves, which became dogs, once prey on humans? How did humans begin to domesticate them, or did the wolves domesticate the humans?
You know, that's one of the most interesting stories in the whole domestication saga, is that, yes, for eons, humans and wolves competed with each other, probably killed each other at every opportunity. But somehow, some of these wolves came to exploit human encampments, probably for scraps. And those that could tolerate human proximity, relatively, had a certain kind of advantage over those that couldn't, in that they had a reliable food supply. Now, those that lived near the camps, so yes, it was initiated by the wolves themselves. Those that lived near human encampments were fed a diet that was somewhat different from the diet that they would get in the wild. And they probably became smaller than their wild cohorts, in which case they would have been at a disadvantage outside of the human environment with respect to other wolves. So there would be this kind of evolutionary divergence between those wolves that were more dependent on human provisions and those that were more in a state of nature.
Is that why you write domestication has unintended consequences?
Well, the unintended consequences, especially with respect to, this applies to natural selection in general, is that there's often a target of selection, but the target, say in this case, tameness, is linked to other traits, even physical traits. It turns out, to these very interesting experiments conducted in the Soviet Union, that selection for tameness caused a host of other alterations in the body. For example, a shortening of the snout, shortening of the legs, of the tail, an upcurled tail. And some of these experiments, I don't know if I mentioned, were done on foxes. In some cases, the ears became floppy, as we see in so many dogs. And behaviorally, they barked, which is not a fox behavior, and so on. So all this was the result of selection for one trait, tameness, which is we can define as ability to tolerate close human proximity without fear or aggression.
So they bred the wolves and the foxes that were less aggressive and eventually wound up with tame animals?
Yes, in fact, after I think it's 50-plus generations now, they've adopted many out as pets, indoor pets.
Were early humans also eating dogs?
Yes.
And still do in some places.
They still do, in a number of places. But throughout the dog-human relationship, it's been sort of fluid in with respect to how much on the sort of pet food continuum. In the New World in particular, where it's thought that dog eating really, they raised the bar on dog eating. Partly it was thought because of the dearth of other larger mammals relative to the old world. But in Mexico, for example, they bred certain breeds of dogs, which they fed on cornmeal, just to be grilled.
Weren't humans evolving as well and changing the way that they were hunting with dogs as their companions, in fact, their aid in hunting?
Yes, and they're evolving in a cultural way, not a biological way. Some people think that this hunting with human-dog cooperation hunting goes way back and explains why humans outcompeted Neanderthals. Now, I don't ascribe to that, but more recently, once humans invented arrows as opposed to thrusted spears, dogs are particularly useful in tracking down the prey that were hit. And this could have been a huge advantage for those cultures that had dogs that cooperated in those ways versus cultures that didn't.
What happens with feral dogs? They were domesticated once and then go wild. In time, do they start looking more like wolves?
Yes, and the dingo is a great example of that. I mean, the dingo was dropped off in northern Australia sometime between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. And the Aborigines really didn't know what to make of the dingo. They'd been in Australia for 40,000 plus years, and they'd never had any experience with dogs. So pretty much the dingoes were free to do whatever they wanted, and they became quite feral. And they're very interesting in that they're sort of have a lot of traits that are intermediate between domesticated dogs and wolves. For example, their canine teeth are about halfway between dogs and wolves. They also, you know, this ability, I think you mentioned about to read human intentions that dogs are so famous for, which is utterly lacking in wolves. Dingoes have a little bit of it, but not nearly as much as domestic dogs. So dingoes have had thousands of years of this sterilization process. But what I find interesting, too, is that they still retain certain domesticated traits. I mean, they're not wolves. They're something altogether different from either domestic dogs or wolves.
They're feral dogs.
Yes, they're feral dogs.
And can we say the same thing about cats, which remain wilder than dogs when they're domesticated, but they're still not the same as wild cats?
Yes, cats, and with cats, the feralization is much more rampant. In fact, most of the cats in the world today probably are feral. And again, you get this sort of intermediate kind of state. A wild cat is an extremely solitary, aggressive, and territorial animal. The domestic cats are quite social, by contrast. Even feral domestic cats live in colonies, which would never happen in a wild cat. And in some of these colonies, mothers will nurse offspring that are not even their own. So that's quite a degree of cooperation. But the domestic cats have also evolved an interesting social signal, which is totally absent in wild cats, which is called the tail up. And that's a signal of friendly intentions. Now, I have two cats, and one of them not only does a tail up, but she shakes it. So you especially notice when she's feeling friendly.
Now, what about the development of breeds? Because there are a lot of different breeds of cats and dogs. How much of that was just done naturally through normal evolution? How much of that is the result of human intervention?
Yes, well, the breed concept was really only developed in the 19th century. Before that, we had what we could consider land races, which were local populations that are adapted to the local environment, both the physical environment and the human cultural environment. And from these land races in the 19th century, breeds were constructed with the advent of kennel clubs. So the breeds are entirely a human invention.
Now,
we know.
I know a dairy farmer who's concerned that breeding cows for their milk has made them unhealthy. And he's been breeding them back, he says, to something like their Neolithic state.
Is that right? Well, that's interesting because economically, I don't know how that'll work, but it's a worthwhile project because it's true. I mean, when you think of some of these hyper-uttered Holsteins that you see, their udders are almost grotesquely enlarged, and they have to be milked twice a day for their own health.
And he says what happens is that they produce a lot of milk for a brief time, and then they get sick. His cows produce less milk, but over a longer period winds up just as much milk, and they don't get sick.
Is that right? Well, I was not familiar with that, and that sounds like a very interesting approach and one that would be both kind of ethically and environmentally more sound.
And they look interesting because they have long brown hair. And they prefer not to stay in pastures but in glens because hair camouflages them.
Now, how long have you been breeding these cows?
Well, for a while now, but he produces cheeses and other things. We have to take a little break. My guest is Richard C. Francis, a science journalist with a Ph.D. in neurobiology. He's the author of Epigenetics and Why Men Don't Ask for Directions, and now Domesticated Evolution in a Man-Made World. It is published by Norton, and we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopatin. When we come back, I also want to talk about cows and sheep and whatever else we can get to, yaks, perhaps, and, of course, we want to find out what our listeners are thinking. So stay with us. And we are back with Richard C. Francis, whose latest book is Domesticated Evolution in a Man-Made World. It's published by Norton. We're talking about the domestication of animals and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Our first call is Ed from Manhattan. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Good. Hi. I want to thank you for a wonderful, wonderful talk. My question concerns some animals, domesticated dogs, their ears become floppy and others don't. Is there any reason for that?
Yes. There are some dogs were actually bred to be more wolf-like, and some are actually more closely related to wolves, such as the Malamutes and Huskies. So their ears never became floppy. Now, some dogs, like the Dobermans, on the other hand, have floppy ears, and they have to be cropped and then a post put in them so that they look like the unfloppy wild-type ear.
Now, they don't have to be cut. They do it just because of the same reason make poodles look silly?
Exactly.
What's the difference between a phenotype and a genome, and how does that play a role in understanding domestication?
Yeah, that's a good question. The genotype is basically our genetic constitution, which we now call the genome. The phenotype is our manifest physical and behavioral traits. And the mapping of the genome on the phenotype is a very complicated one. So what evolution actually sees is the phenotype, not the genotype. So this is why many people are moving from a sort of genocentric view of evolution to what I call a phenocentric view of evolution. And some, such as Mary Jane West Eberhard, claim that goes far as to say that phenotypes lead, genes follow.
Pigs are an integral part of human agriculture, but they're often portrayed as dirty and disgusting. How did they get that reputation? Are they dirty and disgusting in the wild? Don't they just like to hang out in the woods?
Exactly. There's nothing dirty and disgusting about a wild pig. I'm a huge pig fan. So they're smart. They're wily. They're extremely adaptable in their diet, and that's why ultimately they were so useful as domesticates. Where they got the reputation for being smelly and dirty is the conditions under which we kept them, and which is only the degree of disgustingness of which is only accelerated till we have these industrial pig farms where they can't move and their excrement drops down into these huge vats underneath them, without huge fans, they would die of asphyxiation, of sulfur poisoning.
And mothers, of course, add to that reputation. Your room looks like a pigsty.
Yes, right. And that sty is the key word there, because if the pigs are out roaming freely, they would not use pigs in that way.
You mentioned that they have a reputation for being very smart. Can they understand human commands and gestures like dogs?
Yes. Most people who have had pigs are just blown away by their intelligence. And I believe there's some that can even have been even taught to manipulate computer-like devices.
The cows are considered docile and calm. Is there a big difference between modern cows and their wild ancestors?
Yeah, the wild ancestors of modern cows were just one of the most formidable animals that humans at that time faced. And
they were called aurochs?
They were called aurochs, exactly. And they illustrated aurochs. A lot of the cave paintings in southern France are aurochs, so they obviously were infatuated with them. When Caesar invaded Gaul, aurochs had been extinct in Italy for some time, but they were still present in Gaul. And when he saw one, he was just blown away by their magnificence and their belligerence.
You talked about how the modern domesticated cows have huge udders. What about bulls? Have they changed as a result of domestication?
Yes. One thing that often happens in domestication, not only with cow but sheep, goats, and a host of others, is that the sex differences diminish. So the size, there's a sexual dimorphism in size in many mammals. And in bulls, sheep, and goats, that size difference between males and females has shrunk somewhat. Also, there tends to be a reduction in horns, another sort of so-called secondary sexual characteristics, because of a reduction in sexual selection. These horns function, in male, establishing male dominance and in attracting females. But once humans take over the mate choice process, once we assign mates, this sexual selection is diminished. And with it go a lot of these traits like horns.
Now, has the same process occurred, forgetting about the horns, with other domesticated animals, goats, sheep, horses, yaks,
yes,
et cetera?
Exactly. It seems less so in yaks for whatever reason, but the goats and sheep are often born, there are certain breeds at least that don't have horns at all. They're called polled. So that's the extreme end. But all, very few domesticated breeds of sheep, even those that have been feral for a long time, have anything like those massively curving horns, which we see in a bighorn, and also the ancestor of the domestic sheep.
Let's take a call from Josh from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Josh.
Yes. My wife and I, 6 months ago, got a brand new gray, beautiful cat that we love, a little kitten, about a year old now. And we have another cat that we've had for 14 years. And the little kitten, Rennie, has been attacking Sophie and urinating outside the litter and scratching up furniture. And we went to our veterinarian to see what we could do, and we put him on some meds that can affect how much he urinates outside the litter, and calms him down, and he's still attacking her. And the vet said, a good cat is a cat that's alone. And
I've never heard that before. I've seen a lot of cats very happy with other cats, in fact.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead, Richard.
We had, we put down another cat about 7 months ago, another beautiful gray cat that had cancer. And they were like yin and yang. They sleep together. These two cats, they may occupy the same sofa, but that's about as close as it gets, like the opposite ends.
So,
cats are smart, and they have personalities, and sometimes the personalities clash. Now, especially you got that huge age difference there that's got to complicate things as well. But I have two cats, a brother and sister, that are inseparable. And in fact, when they were spayed and neutered, respectively, they usually keep those animals in separate recovery cages. But Sylvester, the male, was so distraught that they had to put him in with Smoke, the female, just to calm him down. So, cats are way more social than people give them credit for.
But people have been writing in about various cat behaviors. Some wonder whether cats make the same noises in the wild as they do when they are domesticated. Do feral cats purr, for example? Do they meow at each other the way they do to humans when they want to be fed?
Those two traits, the purring, meowing, are juvenile traits that were the product of domestication. They're juvenile traits in wildcats. So wildcats, adults never purr or meow. Domestic cats, of course, do that. The feral cats still have those behaviors, but they don't. The meow in particular seems, some people think, evolved as a way to get human attention. I mean, that they arrived at the frequencies that we can't ignore, basically. Mm-hmm. I had an older cat once, it was in the room. I couldn't talk on the phone. It meowed so loud. But.
I'm going to sneak one more call in here. Kathy from West Islip, hi, you're on the air.
I'm wondering if the Asian elephants that are trained and used in forestry in Thailand and that they were in Burma, if they would be considered domesticated, or what's going on there? Are they just wild animals who've been trained? What would you say about that?
That's a great question. And they are not domesticated. They're the difference between tameness, such as you see in those well-trained elephants, and the sort of evolved tameness that you see in domesticated animals, is that there have been genetic alterations in their emotional response. In those elephants, there has been no such genetic alteration. They could be released into the wild, and they'd be act just like normal elephants.
The same would be true with dolphins and any number of other trainable mammals.
Sure, and or squirrels, for that matter.
What about rabbits? Another listener wonders about rabbits.
Rabbits are domesticated. They were domesticated about 3,000 years ago, at least by Roman times, something during the Greek period in the Mediterranean region.
But not the ones who attacked Jimmy Carter.
What's interesting too is that once the rabbits were domesticated, they invaded areas where they were never native, including Northern Europe, including England. So then they created problems, and so polecats were domesticated into ferrets, partly to deal with that problem, as well as rats and mice.
So by domesticating troublesome animals, we wind up making them nicer and friendlier, in some cases making them into pets, in other cases making them into animals who serve us, oxen who plowed the fields for a long time.
That's exactly right. Cattle has long been beasts of burden, has been a very important role. Even meat was the first function. The hides were useful, but they sort of, during the agricultural revolution, they really became useful for plowing, for a host of other activities.
And horses, just seconds to go. But horses, are they pretty much the same as they would be in the wild, except that they've been tamed?
No, horses are actually quite different than they would be in the wild. They're less robust. They're slimmer. They have the mane of a horse is totally different from the mane of their wild ancestors. The wild ancestors had a short, bushy mane, and that long mane of horses, which many find so beautiful, is a product of domestication.
Richard C. Francis's book is Domesticated Evolution in a Man-Made World, published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.